So we're going into the sixth chapter of the book of Daniel. And we're going to talk about the things that happened something like, 2 years, maybe 3 years after the last lesson that we have. Now the sixth chapter gives, I suppose, one of the most well-known Bible stories of all time. I think one of the earliest stories that I remember hearing from the Bible was, first of all, how that the Lord Jesus was crucified. And many times I heard my grandmother recite that event, and also my parents. I remember, too, how that they would tell me the story about Daniel in the lion's den. I remember that just about as far back as I can remember any event of my life. That was a very fond memory of childhood. And it is a good story. What's so remarkable about it is that it is a true story. It is not based on fiction, but on fact. So this is going to be the account we'll be looking at. The best I can calculate, it's been about 2 years since the events back in chapter 5. It could be three, or it might just be one. I don't know. But anyway, the Medo-Persians have gained control now of the kingdom of Babylon. And Daniel has had a rather exalted position in the kingdom of Babylon during the time of Nebuchadnezzar, Nabonidus, and others that have reigned. But he does not have quite that same position in the Medo-Persian rule, though he does seem to be one of the three chief officers under Darius the Mede. So he still has a position, but not quite the position that he once had. But as we go into this lesson, we're going to see that Darius had seen what a remarkable man he was. He was ready to make him his second in command. There was quite a bit of problems that grew out of that, as we're going to see. Now this man, Darius the Mede, is hard to identify in history. Scholars cannot agree. There are some that believe that he was Cambyses, who was the son of Cyrus, and who may have been made ruler of Babylon by his father. Of course, he's called here in the Bible Darius the Mede, and that's all we know about him. There are others then that think that he may have been some other rulers. And as to which one he may have been, I would not be sure. It really has little bearing on our lesson. All I know is what the Bible said about him. He was Darius the Mede. I don't know much more than that. I'll leave the unraveling of the puzzle to the historians that know more about it than I do. Now, during the reign of this man Cyrus, who was the one that we read all that prophecy about in the book of Isaiah the last time, but under the reign of this man Cyrus, there was a lot of good things that happened to the Jewish people. And no doubt, a certain amount of that was influenced by Daniel's position in the government. How much, we shall never know. But anyway, it was under the reign of Darius the Mede, and during the time of the reign of Cyrus over the Medo-Persian kingdom, that the Jews were enabled to go back to their land and reestablish the government there once again in Israel and to rebuild the temple, at least to some degree. Now, evidently this rebuilding of the temple and that restoration in a measure of the Israelite nation did not occur exactly at the time. We cannot be sure, but anyway, we know that it was about 538 to 537 B.C. That's about as close as we can come to the time of the return of the Jews under Cyrus. Now, if that be the time, then that would have been a few months before the episode of Daniel and the lion's den. So what I want you to see there is that because Daniel was exalted to a position of prominence, no doubt that decree under Cyrus for the Jews to return took place through his influence. And so the chronology there is important because it was after the episode of the lion's den, or would have been a few months there before the episode of Daniel and the lion's den. Now, some scholars can't agree. Some say it was before and some say it was after, and I'm not sure. I listed here the most probable thing that's said, and that is it's a few months before the lion's den. There are many that believe that it happened before and that led up to it. I'm inclined somewhat to that idea. So the decree of Cyrus, whether before or after, was no doubt influenced by Daniel. Of that, we can be absolutely sure. I would that I could be more definite about those historical events, but I cannot. I've just given you the rambling of the various scholars. But now we're going to look at the Bible, and of the details there, we can be more certain. We have the political setup in verse 1 to 3 of the 6th chapter. We see the political world of Cyrus, Darius, and of the days of Daniel. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 princes, which should be over the whole kingdom. Well, we can see right quick that the rule of the Medo-Persians was not like that of the Babylonians. In the case of the Babylonian rule, you had an aristocracy. You had just one man ruling the entire kingdom of Babylon, and his word was law. So you had an absolute monarchy there under Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, under Nabonidus, no doubt the other rulers of Babylon. But now we have more like a president and a congress, shall we say. We have Darius being over the kingdom of Babylon. And then we have 120 princes that are over the whole kingdom. So then there was like the prime minister and the parliament, or the president and the congress. Though it certainly perhaps was no way like the modern forms that we have in England and the United States. You had other men, though, that shared in the government. It was not an absolute monarchy, as was the Babylonian rule. So what we see here is that as we go down the image, as we learned back in chapter 2, that there is the giving to the people of more authority in the government. And here's the proof of it in chapter 6 and verse 1. So these 120 princes there are over the whole kingdom. So they're sharing the kingdom with Darius the Mede. And these fellows were called the kingdom protectors, or the satraps. And sometimes we might call them today like governors. That would be more like what they would have been in that time. It would have been something like a governor or the sheriff of a county or something to that effect. Though none of it would completely compare to the modern form of government we have. And so then we find that Daniel is the first of the three presidents. They evidently were like the vice president or something there, the cabinet underneath Darius the Mede, who is the king. And over these three presidents, of whom Daniel was first, that the princes might give an account unto them. So now this 120 princes would report to Daniel and these other two men that were called the presidents. Then what else would happen? And the king should have no damage. So while the president, we might say, there are the three of them, Daniel and his two companions, they heard the reports of all of this 120 princes. And it was their business to see that no damage came to the king. So they were the watchdogs, we'll say. They were the fellows that went out to make sure that this 120 fellows did their job. So that was their responsibility. No doubt these three presidents then, in turn, were definitely responsible to the king himself. So it was not a bad system of government when you think about it. You had three men there that kept a watch on the 120 provinces that these princes were over. And then, of course, they had to report to the king. So it was a pretty good setup. A little bit like our modern form of government. So Daniel is still exalted here, but not as exalted as he may have once been, because there's slightly different form of government here. Now God and others had exalted him, there's no doubt about it. He did not exalt himself. Never in this book do we find where Daniel exalted himself. God and other people exalted him. Daniel did not exalt himself. We see a lot today of men trying to exalt themselves. It was never true of this man Daniel. And then in verse 3 we find Daniel the chief and a little bit about him. Then this Daniel was preferred above the presidents and princes. That is, evidently preferred by the king, maybe some of the people. Because an excellent spirit was in him. I believe that was the Holy Spirit, spoken of back in chapter 5 and verse 12. The only excellent spirit that any man could have would be the Holy Spirit. And if he has an excellent sweet spirit, as we sometimes speak of it, It is simply because that he has the Holy Spirit within, and that Spirit is bearing the fruit that's spoken of in the book of Galatians chapter 5, the latter part. So that excellent Spirit was the indwelling Holy Spirit, the Spirit that indwelt all of the Old Testament saints. Now, the king evidently has some plans here to elevate Daniel to a very high position, make him what we'd call a second in command. He already was just about that, but he was just about to almost make him the king, and he is going to kind of retire, sound like, the way it reads in the latter part there. And the king thought to set him over the whole realm. So he would be going to be the second in command there, the king, like he was to Nebuchadnezzar. And so there was quite a bit of political ability there in Daniel. Now this man, Darius the Mede, I doubt is saved. He may be. He has a lot of faith in Daniel's God, but whether he has saving faith is a matter of question. I would hope that after the lion's den experience that he may have had more faith. But anyway, he's looking from the political standpoint, the administrative ability, the talents, and all of this that Daniel has. And he says, now this man is smarter than all of these others. He can be trusted. He's a reliable fellow that I can trust the government to. So I believe that I'm going to make him the second in command to me. I'm pretty well going to let him run the affairs of the kingdom. Maybe he thought that Daniel might do better than he'd do. And so he's just pretty well going to turn it over to him and kind of stand on the sideline. Well, I'm not so sure, but what it wouldn't have been a wise move, come to think of it. I think it probably would have been very good. And I wish maybe he had done that. But there's always somebody, you know, especially in the political world. If you are going to be elevated, if you're going to be elected to a higher office, there's somebody there that'll try to put you out. One time I had a man who was at least an honorable politician, and there are not many of those today. He told me, he said, there's something remarkable that happens when a fellow's elected to public office. He said, as soon as a man's elected to public office, he said, there's always a bunch of people that'll rise up and try to get him thrown out. He said, now, it doesn't make a difference whether he's doing a good job or not. He said, sometimes maybe he needs to be. But he said, there's always somebody that wants to put him out. And he said, there's a trend among voters today because of the dissatisfaction of the top leaders and all that we have in public office, that a lot of times they're going down to the polls not so much to put a man in as they are to make sure that a certain fellow don't get back. And he said, it's really a sign of a sick political situation in this country. And there's a lot of truth to that. Now, what about you? Have you ever gone to make sure that some fellow didn't get back? I've gone a few times. I'm going to admit it. Yeah, I went down there not so much maybe to get somebody else elected, but to make sure that certain fellows didn't get back. I'll tell you one thing, when Henry Kissinger was representing this country, I certainly was going to vote so as to make sure he didn't continue that job. I don't make any bones about it. I sure did go and vote to put him out, because I wanted him out. He betrayed the trust of this country. So I suppose there were some fellows there that were determined to get this Jew thrown out. That's about what it amounted to. They said, after all, he's a foreigner. What business has he got over here trying to run this kingdom? He's not a Persian. He's not a Babylonian. How could he qualify to be the second in command to the king? After all, he's an old man. He ought to be turned out to pasture. Well, this fellow's almost 90 years old. He's past the flower of his age. Of what possible benefit could he be to this kingdom? Well, it could be a lot of benefit because years had taught him a lot of experience and a lot of things that would be worthwhile, but they didn't look at it that way, I'm sure. So envy, and that's all I know to call it, envy provoked a treacherous plot. They're going to get rid of this old Jew. They don't like him. So they're going to get rid of him. And so an occasion of accusation comes about because of personal ambition. It wasn't so much that they wanted Daniel thrown out as it was that they wanted his job. That's what it was all about, you see. They wanted that office that he had. At least some of those men did. And so they're going to investigate him. They said, we believe we'll have a little Watergate investigation. Who knows? Maybe he's got a Watergate. Maybe we can uncover some corruption in his regime. And we'll go tell the king about it, and we'll get him fired. Then we'll get him thrown out of his office. So they set out to conduct a political investigation. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think it's probably a good practice. I would, though, that all the men in office would come out, as did Daniel. because we've seen this past year in our government a great deal of corruption, men being thrown out for being homosexuals and being thrown out for statutory rape and various other things. A few years before that, another man was thrown out because he was an alcoholic. So you see, when these Watergate investigations are conducted, a lot of times they find a lot of scandal. And perhaps if we knew all the scandal on some of the leaders of our country, we'd want them all thrown out if the real truth were known. But they didn't find any Watergate in the case of Daniel. He was a man of sterling character, and he was blameless even before his enemies. Now, how many of us could live up to that standard? That's pretty strong doctrine there when you think about it. Even his enemies couldn't find any fault with him. Well, some of us might not be as fortunate. Then the presidents, that's the two men that's supposed to be his colleagues and the princes, I don't know whether it was the whole 120 or at least a good portion of them, sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the kingdom. A little treason, maybe. A little mishandling of funds or something. But they could find none occasion nor fault. No Watergate, see. For as much as he was faithful, he never misappropriated any funds. He was never disloyal to the king. He never failed to execute his office. He was a top man in the government that the whole world needs. We need men like that. For as much as he was faithful, neither was there any error or fault found in him. So I tell you that a man is indeed a good man when you cannot find any error or fault, that is, his enemies. You understand now why that it's said that Daniel was one of the most three righteous men in the Bible? Compared to Noah, and is it Joseph? I believe it's the other one that I'm thinking of. I've forgotten, but there were three righteous men. Ezekiel spoke of them, and he said that Job, and then he mentions Daniel. And so here's one of the most righteous men that we find in the Bible. Even his enemies could not find any fault with him. And so since they can't find any disloyalty to the king or no political conspiracies against the king, they said he's a very devout man in his religion. Surely we can find something about his religious practices, you know, to criticize him about and to bring him before the king. I'm surprised they didn't think of that first, but they didn't. So they're going to strike at his religion. After all, they said he's a foreigner. He doesn't worship the gods of Babylon. He doesn't worship the gods of the Persians. And we believe that we found something here we can get against him. So they're going to examine his religion. Then said these men, we shall not find any occasion against this Daniel, except we find it against him concerning the law of his God. Well, there's one thing for sure, Daniel was not an antinomian. He was obeying the law of his God. He's keeping it to the letter. And so they said, now if there's something about the way he obeys his God and his God's law, if we can pin a rap on him from that, then I believe we've got a good point. So that's what they're going to set out to do. You know, if people can't find fault with our official life, our social gestures, our civic spirit in the community and the like, then what? They'll find fault with the way that we worship God, with the doctrines we believe, with the God that we claim we believe in and all of that. That's what happened to Daniel too. So they assembled there hastily before the king, evidently with Daniel absent. And they got all sorts of speeches to make. Then these presidents and princes assembled together to the king and said, thus unto him, King Darius, live forever. That's the ordinary way they would address the king. All the presidents of the kingdoms, the governors, the princes, the counselors, and captains have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whosoever shall ask the petition of any god or man for 30 days save of thee, O king, he shall be cast into the den of lions. So now they've come up with a real proposal, hadn't they? Well, it must have sounded real good to the king because they said, we're going to make you God for a month. That's what they really told him. He said, we're going to make you a God for a month. Said, everybody's going to have to pray to you and going to have to ask things of you. What are they doing? They're appealing to the vanity of his nature. They said, you're such a great king, a wonderful man, that we want everybody to pray to you and everybody respect you. We don't think you're getting enough respect as a ruler. Well, boy, that sounded good, you know. He bought that right quick. Didn't take him too long to buy that bill of goods. Another thing that made it more convenient for them to propose that, it was assumed that the king represented one of the chief gods of the kingdom. And furthermore, that the princes, presidents, and others, that they were the representatives of other gods that were in the kingdom. So then it wasn't hard to sell him on this bill of goods. He bit the bait right quick. They said, we're going to make you God for 30 days. And he thought, well, now, boy, that's great. After all, I'm supposed to be the representative of God to the people, so they're just going to elevate me a little bit and just make me God. Boy, that's going to be great, he said. That just sounds good to me. I believe that's exactly what I'd like to see done. Of course, now they're doing it, saying that we're going to make it nice for you. But the real plot was to get at Daniel, you see. They didn't really think that much of the king. As a matter of fact, they're going to criticize him a little later on here if you watch close. So they said they're going to make him a god now for a month. And I'm afraid that the king was pretty much of a politician because he said, well, that's good news, boys. I'm going to go along with that decree. But you'll note the way that it's said there that this decree had to be established by the counselors, the captains, the governors, and the presidents as well as the king, which means that the king himself probably couldn't have broke that decree. That when it was signed by him and all these men, it became the law of the kingdom. And before it could be broken, they would all have to agree to the breaking of it. That accounts for why Darius could not overthrow the decree. That's why the law of the Medes and the Persians could not be altered or changed. So in other words, it was like a bill in Congress, going through the House, going through the various branches and all, then being signed by the president, and it became the law of the land. And they themselves could not suddenly just change all of that. So they're really going to fix it up so he can't get out of this decree when once it's signed. So he's going to sign the decree in ignorance of the plot, of course, against Daniel. So they're pleading with him in verse 8. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing that it may not be changed. In other words, once this is signed, now it becomes the law of the kingdom. The king himself cannot alter or change it. According to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which altereth not. So even the king himself would be bound by this law once that he puts his name to the decree. So he was not like Nebuchadnezzar, who could overthrow any decree and was himself the one that made the decrees. And so they say, wherefore King Darius signed the writing and the decree. Well, I can see the old king. He's greatly impressed. He said, I believe I would like to be God for a month. So I can see him as he signed his name and he puts his royal seal, which was probably a ring that had an insignia in it of some sort, a royal seal of the kingdom. He put that on there and maybe in some wax or something. And he made it a legal state document. It's the law of the kingdoms of the Medes and the Persians. It cannot be altered or changed. So I can see those old boys, they go home kind of a little smile on their face, said, now we've done it. Now we've done it. Said, we're going to get rid of this old Jew after all. Said, we're going to get rid of him. We've got it all planned now, just exactly like we wanted. The king bit the bait and everything's good. We really swung the deal in our direction. Of course, Daniel, evidently, he knows about the decree. And being the intelligent man he was, he no doubt knew about this conspiracy, too. I'm sure that he was not ignorant of any of this that had taken place. So he evidently was absent at the time, because had he been there, he would have contested. So they waited until Daniel was gone. They took advantage of him. That's exactly what they did. There's no mention of Daniel being there. But anyway, he shortly after that learns about the signing of this, shall I call it a state document. But he didn't make any change in his religious life. He didn't care what they'd done. He was going to go on serving God. So down there in verse 10 to 14, we have Daniel's faithfulness and steadfastness in the faith. Now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, evidently some messenger told him, he went into his house, and his windows being open in his chamber toward Jerusalem. He kneeled upon his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he did aforetimes. So now they've made a law that you cannot worship Daniel's God, but Daniel goes right on worshiping his God, showing us that we are to obey God and not man, that we are to obey the law of the land so long as it is not contradictory to the law of God. If and when it becomes contradictory to the law of God, we must obey the law of God and ignore the law of the land. That certainly would apply to the 1963 ruling of the Supreme Court about prayer and Bible reading in public schools, as far as I'm concerned. Now, the decree was likely proclaimed publicly by proper channels so that all the people knew about it, not only Daniel, but the whole empire. Daniel probably even knew about the investigation of his life and work. I guess he had to face a decision at that point, didn't he? Would he continue to pray? He could have said, well, I believe I'll just outfox these old boys. I just won't pray for 30 days. And after that decree then is abolished, then I'll go back and pray to God after that. In other words, I'll temporarily backslide. That's about what it would have amounted to. And he could have said, well, now look, if I've got to risk my life at this prayer, I believe maybe that I ought to just postpone praying for about 30 days, and sometime after that, then I'll start up the prayer meeting again, you know. He didn't reason like that. He went right into that special room in the upper chamber, which is probably the second part of the floor of the building, into a special room where there was council and private meetings took place, and no doubt he's alone there in this chamber, and he goes right on praying to God like he'd always done. Now, he wasn't the sort of fellow that hadn't been praying, and because they passed the law, he decided he'd start praying just so as to make them mad, you know. He just kept up his same devotions to God. So he continued his open, public, unashamed devotion to God. And whether that was approved or disapproved made no difference to him. He said, well, I tell you what, I believe if I'd been in his boat, I'd have done a little bit different. Well, I would hope that we wouldn't have, but we might have. I would hope that we would not have compromised, but that we would have stood fast. So it's remarkable that a man who is, you might say, almost second in command to the king, had time to go and pray 3 times a day. Now, you and I, you know, sometimes we ask about this praying thing, and say, well, it seems like I just don't have time, you know, I'm too busy. Do you really think you got more business than Daniel had? I don't think there's anybody here in this church that's got more business probably than Daniel had back in that day running all those various affairs of the kingdom. He prayed 3 times a day. He didn't get too busy to serve God. Probably it was a custom of the Jews to pray 3 times a day, and it might be a good custom for us. Have you ever thought about it? There's no place in the Bible that says we can't do it. And in the Psalms, which we're told in the New Testament to use for Bible doctrine, Psalms 55 and 17, it says, evening and morning and at noon will I pray and cry aloud, and he shall hear my voice. So the Jews, they had what they call the hour of prayer. They would go up to the temple and pray 3 times a day at the hour of prayer. Well, a lot of the people that belong to other religions in the world, they pray 3 times a day. They fast so many days a week and all of that. So sometimes we use that excuse, we're too busy to pray. No, we're not. We don't have any more business. We don't even have as much business as Daniel had. We're just lazy and indifferent toward our responsibility. Let's tell it like it is. Yes, we ought to pray 3 times a day. It's not too much for God to expect us to do that. Well, the conspirators now, they're excited. They say, well, we're going to slip over there now and get in the upper story right across from him. And when he opens up that window, we're going to watch and see whether or not he prays. That's what I think they did. They knew the normal time that he prayed, and no doubt they purposely assembled. Maybe the building next door, shall we say, and they looked out the window. I don't know whether Daniel saw him or not. It didn't make any difference to him whether he's there or not. He's going to go right on and do what he did. He didn't pay any attention to him if they were over there gazing at him at this time. Then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. When they got there to investigate, they began to look in the door of the building or look from another building that was nearby. They said, there he is. He's just like we thought. So he's in there praying to his God. He's offering this prayer up to Jehovah, and he's looking there toward Jerusalem, capital city of his people. You know, sometimes people will gang up on a man that is devoted to his religion, and they'll assemble to try to find some fault with it. Maybe sometimes they assemble to find faults with the preacher or the leaders in the church. And so it ought not to be, but that's what they're doing here. So now they just can't wait. They said, we've got the goods on him. We're just going to run right down there to the king, and we're going to tattle on him. We're going to go tell the teacher on him. So they do. They go running down to Darius. Can't wait, no doubt, to get down there. I can imagine they didn't waste any time speeding down there to tell him about this man praying to a God that was not him and all of that. In other words, you've been made to God, and said he's not praying to you, he's praying to Jehovah. So they get all excited. So here they go down to the king to try to tell him about this man being a traitor. You know, he ought to be killed and all that. Then they came near and spake before the king concerning the king's decree. Hast thou not signed a decree? Of course, they don't tell him that they were the fellows that got up the idea and proposed it to him and sold him on it. Hast thou not signed a decree that every man that shall ask the petition of any god or man within 30 days, save of thee, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? Well, the king remembered that he'd done that. They want to remind him, though. Now, they make it appear here that he had it all conjured up in his mind, and he had the decree, but it was really their decree, and they just got him to sign it. So the king answered and said, the thing is true. He didn't deny what he'd done. According to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which altereth not. Now really, in a sense there, what they're going to do, they're going to say, now, you weren't smart putting this man Daniel in the government. You were pretty dumb. That was a dumb move. Because he's already defied you. He's disloyal. But in reality, Daniel in no way had been disloyal to the king. He just would refuse to be disloyal to his God. And he did not see that his loyalty to God should have any bearing upon his loyalty to the king. He felt that he could be loyal to both. But whenever it came to the duty of the greater king, he would render the duty, of course, to God. So now he wasn't being disrespectful of the king by praying. He was just praying to the greater king. But anyway, they go in and they make this accusation against him, and they say, now he's been a bad little boy, you're going to have to try to do something with him. And so they remind him of what he's done and all of that, and then the king begins to get just a little bit alarmed as they begin to narrow it down and say, now here is a culprit that we came to talk about. Then answered they and said before the king, that Daniel, which is of the children of the captivity of Judah, they evidently don't like Jews, do they? Regardeth not thee, O king, nor the decree that thou hast signed, but maketh his petition three times a day. So they're really charging him almost with treason there, as well as being disloyal to the gods of Babylon. Well, I think the old king has wised up now. He said, somebody sold me a bill of goods, and I bid on the thing too soon. But what? He can't change the decree. Then the king, when he heard these words, was sore displeased with himself. He wasn't so much mad at these men as he was mad at himself for being such a dummy and signing a decree like that, that they definitely intended to get rid of Daniel by it. So he thought, well, I've been a dummy. I guess he felt like kicking himself in the seat of the pants, as we say. He thought, how could I be so dumb? How could I be so dumb as to concur with this awful decree that they brought to me? Why didn't I investigate that matter some more? But the king was a busy man and probably in haste. He thought, with all those fellows backing it up, that it must be a good thing. And he set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. I suppose he called in what we'd say his lawyers and said, is there any way, men, that we can overturn this decree? Is there any way that I can say he's exempt because he's one of the men in the government or something? Is there any loophole in the law whereby I can get him off and all of that? So evidently he labored there till the going down of the sun to deliver him. So far as legal means were available in that day, he employed every legal means at his disposal to try to get the decree overturned, but he could not. There was no way that he could overturn this decree that he had signed. And so it's a very, very sad time for the king. He's greatly alarmed, and he knows that he's been sold on a bill of goods that was to get rid of his good friend and comrade, Daniel. So now they're going to accuse him there before the king, and They're going to try to get him killed and thrown in the lion's den. And of course, the king has done about all that he knows to do, but he hasn't been very successful. So Daniel in the lion's den, we have there in verse 15 to 17. Then these men assembled unto the king and said unto the king, Know, O king, that the law of the Medes and the Persians is that no decree nor statute which the king establisheth may be changed. So they told him about the law, as if he didn't know, him being the king. That would have been insulting to me. Probably was to him. And so then he has to carry out the law. His own decree has to be carried out. Then the king commanded. They brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. So sometimes leaders have to do things against their will because it's the law. Now the king spake and said unto Daniel. Evidently he said this before he threw him in, or maybe shortly thereafter. Our version implies shortly thereafter. In the original, it could have been beforehand. Thy God, whom thou servest continually, he will deliver thee. Did he have any faith in Daniel's God? Look at that. Had some, didn't he? He thought, if I can't do it, surely your God can. I tell you, there's a strong statement there on the perseverance of the saints because Daniel served God continually. He wasn't a Sunday go to meeting Christian. He wasn't a man that was religious one day a week. He is religious all the time, day and night, every day of the week. He served God continually. Never ceased to serve God. He's going to have to go in the lion's den. And a stone was brought and laid upon the mouth of the den. And the king sealed it with his own signet, and with the signet of his lords, that the purpose might not be changed concerning Daniel. So I suppose those boys clapped their hands and said, well, he's gone this time. There's no way he'll ever get out of that lion's den because they'll have him eat up by the time he hits the ground good down there. So the execution of the sentence was carried out on the evening of the same day that the accusation was made. That was in accordance to the Oriental custom of that day. But I tell you, I marvel there at the confidence this man had in Daniel's God. He said, your God, will not your God deliver you, Daniel? That God that you've served all these years, will he not take care of his servant? I don't know whether he'd heard the story about Nebuchadnezzar or not. Maybe he had. I don't know. But I like that expression, whom thou servest continually. Well, that was the Old Testament Christian, shall I say. That's the kind we need in the 20th century too. But I'll tell you what. Daniel had witness to this man. He told him about his God, and he was convinced there was quite a bit to this man's religion. So here was a heathen monarch, who in a sense is almost turned preacher, comforter, and exhorter. He said, Daniel, your God, he'll take care of you. Trying to comfort old Daniel a little bit, sound like there. So the seal is set. And of course, the lords, they go home, no doubt in unholy delight, that their enemy is soon to be executed. Perhaps they think he's already dead by this time. But he's not. God is with Daniel. And that'll be our next study about Daniel actually having experience in the lion's den. Let me ask this question. You know that old lion's den was dark and the king couldn't see down in there even when he rolled away the stone. But you know, if he could have seen down in there, I think he'd have seen two fellows down there too. Not just one, but two.